A quick word from our sponsor, Oakstone CME's ACP MixApp Audio Companion. What would it feel like to have bite-sized MixApp teaching ready to go anywhere with you? Take a listen.
I found it very interesting, the line that points out that observational studies suggest an increase in heart failure with insulin therapy. That's something I hadn't known prior to this exercise.
Yes, and a lot of patients now are interested in considering a GLP-1 receptor agonist. These drugs reduce major adverse cardiovascular events but have no effect or detriment in patients with heart failure.
And on top of the high-yield teaching, they give you supplementary content, monthly multiple-choice questions discussion, so that really brings the clinical pearls to life. It's a really smart way to reinforce key concepts without high-effort setup. For 50 years, Oakstone CME has helped busy clinicians stay current with expert-led education free of outside commercial influence. From board prep to earning CME, their mobile-friendly platforms offer trusted multimedia content designed for learning on the go. Multitask while you absorb the latest medical knowledge with ACP MixApp Audio Companion, a podcast-style tool packed with expert insights, board prep, and more CME credits than ever. You can stream or download anytime. And exclusive for Coram listeners, use the code CORE25 for 25% off. Go to oakstone.com/mixapp. That's oakstone.com/MKSAP. Use the code CORE25. And with that, let's get into the episode.
I have a colleague who's based in the UK who, as a medical student in the UK, had anemia from heavy menstrual periods, very common in women, and then also has the Duffy null phenotype. And so her PCP saw, you know, two cytopenias, a low neutrophil count, and referred her to a hematologist, right? And told her that it might be leukemia. And so she's a stressed out medical student, you know, just trying to get by and thinking that she had leukemia.
That was Dr. Lauren Mertz, a hematologist at the University of Michigan. Welcome to the CORAM 5 Pearls podcast, bringing you high-yield, evidence-based pearls. This is Dr. Sheree Trivedi.
And I'm Dr. Casey Kim, a hematology-oncology fellow at Tufts Medical Center. And today we're bringing you the CORAM episode on neutropenia and febrile neutropenia.
I'm so thankful that you brought this episode to life because I think I learned so much about the nuances of neutropenia. And I think there's a lot of guiding principles that can help us try to figure some of this out a little bit better.
So everyone keep calm and we'll carry on with our new episode on neutropenia and febrile neutropenia with the following 5 pearls. Make sure to test yourself by pausing after each of the 5 questions.
And remember, the more you test yourself, the deeper your learning gains.
Pearl 1, risk stratification of neutropenia.
What level of neutropenia increases your risk of infection? And what are the types of neutropenia that gives you the highest risk of infection?
Pearl 2, workup of neutropenia.
What do you consider when working up new neutropenia and what patterns matter the most?
Pearl 3, timeline of neutropenia recovery.
How long does it take for a patient to recover their neutrophil counts? And what should you counsel patients to do during that process?
Pearl 4, febrile neutropenia.
What is febrile neutropenia and how do you assess and triage these patients?
Pearl 5, management of febrile neutropenia.
How long do you treat febrile neutropenia with antibiotics? And when do you consider adding treatment like antifungals?
5, was about to discharge a patient who was feeling pretty well after his pneumonia was treated. And on the day of discharge, his CBC and absolute neutrophil count was newly about 700.
Ugh, what a tough place to be in. What did you do?
I just discharged him. He was feeling fine, but honestly, I felt a little uneasy sending him out when I knew he was neutropenic.
I know that feeling, especially when we see neutropenia. I think a lot of us think, okay, this is like high risk of infection. But I think as we learned, it's a lot more nuanced than that.
We really like the rules. You know, we like that we have to transfuse at 7 and we always transfuse at 7, whether you're inpatient or in surgery or outpatient. I think we often try to apply the same rules to neutropenia. I think a lot of us learned that an absolute neutrophil count of 1500 or lower counts as neutropenia. And then many of us also learned those subdivisions of, you know, less than 500 is severe, between, you know, 500 and 1,000 is moderate, and 1,000 to 1,500 is mild. I think that we need to step away from a lot of those rigid definitions and instead first look at the patient in front of us and look at their clinical context and look at the numbers themselves lab.
Wait, so where do these numbers come from?
I really started to look into where did we come up with the number 1,500? And I couldn't find a good answer in all of my research. The best I can find is that in the 1980s, we were trying to figure out how to quantify toxicity from chemotherapy. And, you know, back in the 1980s, we were giving some very intense chemotherapy that was totally myeloablative, really big doses. And we were trying to define toxicity in a way that we could all agree with. And that's where that number of 1,500 came from.
So essentially, we've been applying a threshold developed for cancer patients getting intensive chemotherapy to everyone. You know, that seems like a pretty big leap to me.
Right. And then on top of that, what we're measuring in the blood is actually just a tiny snapshot of what's happening in the body.
White blood cells only live in the bloodstream for 3 to 24 hours. You're only seeing 1% to 5% of the mature neutrophils in the blood at any one time. And so I think appreciating that what we see in the blood is an imperfect proxy of what's actually going on in the body, and that there's going to be a ton of fluctuation and variation, even on an hour-by-hour basis, just kind of allows us to appreciate the art of medicine.
You know, I think the variation that we see hour by hour brings up another key point, that you can see variation on the population level as well, too. And in particular, something called Duffy null associated neutropenia.
I'll be honest here. I've heard that term once or twice, but never had a really good grasp on what that actually means clinically.
So Duffy null is a genetic variant in different proteins on different blood cell types that developed primarily as an evolutionary adaptation to malaria, specifically conferring resistance to Plasmodium vivax. But people with this variant typically have lower neutrophil counts in their peripheral blood, even though their total body neutrophil count is completely normal.
So we see in mouse models, hasn't been proven in humans, but we see in mouse models that when you don't have the expression of Duffy, it results in neutrophils that just are phenotypically different and tend to go to the spleen rather than hang out in the periphery. And so the total body neutrophils are the same. What we see in the bone marrow is exactly the same, but the way that we measure blood by taking it from the periphery is going to be different for people who are Duffy null versus Duffy non-null.
Wait, so these patients with Duffy null have a completely normal immune function, but we've just been labeling them as neutropenic because their neutrophils are hanging out in the spleen and not in the periphery, which is where we're taking blood from.
So you can imagine the sort of anxiety and workups that patients and even clinicians go through with, you know, having these lower neutrophil counts.
In medical school, I remember there was a teenager who was quite a soccer star, like in the area, needed an ACL repair, and the surgeons declined to do the ACL repair until he had a hematology workup because neutrophils were at like 1,200, right? So what we know is normal for someone with the Duffy null phenotype was out of the reference ranges at the institution. So there was a delay in his surgery. It took a while to get the hematology. We said everything was okay, but by the time he got back to the surgeons, he had missed a lot of his season, right? And especially as a high schooler who's thinking about college prospects, it's a really big deal. It's hard to quantify these things. How you quantify that stress or the time off work or even just that sense of othering, being told that you're not normal or having your values always be red, but someone tells you you're fine. Your values are red. You're just like that disconnect. It's distressing. There's evidence that people with the Duffy null variant get more bone marrow biopsies. That is not a benign or easy thing to go through, right? It's fine if you need it and it's essential for your clinical care, but that's not a casual test to get. We also see things like azathioprine use for lupus or other autoimmune disease. There is higher rate of discontinuation for people with the Duffy null phenotype.
You know, that's crazy. I can see a bunch of patients who have Duffy null phenotype and who get medications like their clozapine stopped because of neutropenia, even though it's not the clozapine that's causing the neutropenia, but rather just the fact that they have this Duffy null phenotype and a normal ANSI fluctuation.
Yeah, it just makes me wonder, like, how many patients I've seen with neutropenia and how many of those cases I might have missed a Duffy null phenotype.
So sub-Saharan Africa and into the Arabian Peninsula. In West Africa, we often see 80 to 100% of the population with the null phenotype. And in the United States, among people who will self-identify as Black or African-American, we typically see 2 in every 3 people with the null phenotype.
Oh, that demographic is definitely helpful because I think at the back of my mind is I'm thinking, you know, who should I send off a Duffy null on? Is it everyone? And to speak to that a bit more, we sat down with Dr. Jason Fried, a hematologist at BIDMC, and whose voice you may recognize very well from our Gray Matter segment.
So the way I approach isolated neutropenia is that if absolute neutrophil count is 1,000 to 1,500 and they're of African or Middle Eastern ancestry, I send Duffy antigen testing. And if they're Duffy null, which 2/3 of African Americans are, I reassure them, I do no further testing, no bone marrow biopsy, no invasive testing. That's the answer.
So that's helpful on who to send off that test on. What else should we be looking for when we try to distinguish? Is this a normal variation like Duffy null associated neutropenia or some other etiology of neutropenia that, you know, gives a really higher risk of infection?
You know, even though we just spoke about not placing too much value on the absolute number for, you know, the past couple of minutes, it's still good to keep an ANC of 500 in mind. Usually you wouldn't expect to see an ANC of 500 or below in a patient with the Duffy null phenotype. And being below that particular threshold makes me think that you may just not have enough neutrophils in your body to fight off an infection.
So when neutrophils are 500 or less in what we can measure in the blood, we worry that the total body neutrophil counts are low, which means that a person is not going to be able to robustly fight off any sort of infection or disease and might need things like IV antibiotics or closer monitoring more than someone who has an ANC that's 2,000 or higher.
Being below 500 is one of my variables for worry, duration of time that they're going to be less than that, because every day is a dice roll as far as a risk that you're going to get an infection.
Okay, summarize what I'm taking away from this pearl. I think before diving into this, I had a knee-jerk response whenever I see an absolute neutrophil count less than 1,500. Oh, they're neutropenic, increased risk of infection. But we learned that that number came from patients on chemotherapy in the 1980s and not real-world diverse non-cancer patients. And I think definitely going to take away the fact that 2/3 of Black patients in U.S. have a Duffy null phenotype, and they can naturally have lower ANCs but have a normal immune function. The other big shift for me is to not let the number drive the plan, really asking myself, is this new for the patient? Could a Duffy null antigen be at play, especially if they are from an African American or Middle Eastern ancestry? And of course, if that ANC number is under 500, then my worry about infection goes up much higher.
So say your patient is not Duffy null but they are still neutropenic, you know, let's go through how our discussants think through neutropenia and how they would work up these cases.
And so the first thing I'll say is that the standard approach that you use for other cytopenias, it doesn't work as well here. So this other general thing that we use to talk about, is it a production problem? Is it a destruction problem? Or is it splenic sequestration, like the cells are hiding? Like, that's great for anemia and thrombocytopenia. But for neutropenia, it's a little bit more limited in terms of actually getting to a specific diagnosis.
So we can talk about the first branch point in the neutropenia workup. Is this isolated neutropenia or is this pancytopenia? If it's pancytopenia, then you're looking at an entirely different differential. And most of the time, that's straight to bone marrow biopsy.
But what if you just have isolated neutropenia? The red blood cells, the platelets are fine. How do we think through that isolated neutropenia?
If neutropenia is isolated, meaning that's really the only CBC abnormality that you're seeing, it's an entirely different set of causes. Here, hematologic malignancies are not common causes at all. And in fact, here, even doing a bone marrow biopsy is rarely important because most of the time, doing a bone marrow biopsy won't even give you the diagnosis.
9 times out of 10 in a neutropenia evaluation, it's about the history, and it's rarely about the lab tests that you send off. I think a lot of times in our busy healthcare system, we're very dependent on just wanting to send tests and have the tests tell us. Neutropenia is one of those entities where it's really about the history more than about the tests that you send out.
All right. So for neutropenia, it's really our time to turn up our internal medicine history-taking skills and really try to figure out the cause.
Well, the list is pretty long, but you can narrow it down pretty quickly based upon paying attention to a few factors. One is their medications. Two is other diseases that they have. Three is other symptoms they have that you might not have made a specific diagnosis around. Four is the severity of the neutropenia, because completely different things cause you to have severe neutropenia from mild neutropenia. And five is the pattern of the neutropenia. And so here's where having multiple CBCs, the differential, can be really helpful.
So with those five, thinking through meds, what other diseases they have, other symptoms like rheumatologic ones that might signify that's the cause, the severity of the neutropenia, and the pattern of the neutropenia. Thinking through those five things, it was really when we spoke to our experts that the money is really in that first one, the medications. And that is what we're going to focus on.
And just to take a step back, if you've ever been working up a patient for neutropenia, and you're like, okay, well, I know meds are a cause. Let me, you know, go online and see which of the medications this patient's on cause neutropenia. It's crazy making, because you look it up and every single medication has neutropenia listed as a possible side effect. So it's like, what am I supposed to do with that? There are two types of medication-related neutropenia, but they're the same two types of medication-related problems that exist for everything, which is the problem can be dose and duration dependent, or it can be idiosyncratic, also known as immune-mediated. And the reason why that distinction is so important is because the patterns are entirely different, and what you do is entirely different.
All right, so the foundation we need to really cement and dive into when we're thinking about the overwhelming medications category is asking ourselves, is this either a problem due to the duration and dose of a medication, or is this a problem because of an immune-related problem?
So, you know, we can start with the first category of dose and duration-dependent medications, and these medications tend to give you a gradual neutropenia.
And they're probably medicines you already know about. So these are medications like mycophenolate, like azathioprine, like ganciclovir, like 6-mercaptopurine. What do all those drugs have in common? They're all nucleotide analogs, right? They're like basically like the same thing as chemo, right? They obviously affect DNA replication. Now, that should affect all your cell lines, but for whatever reason, they tend to cause neutropenia as a big problem. So those medications, if you're on those and you're neutropenic, there's a good chance it's at least contributing.
You know, I think that's a really good point about dose-dependent effects of medications, but we can also think about duration as well. Take linezolid, for example, which can cause dose and duration-dependent neutropenia. If you use linezolid for a one-week course for cellulitis, you almost never see any significant cytopenias, but it's not the case if you do it for like a 6-week course for endocarditis. In that case, you'll actually see cytopenias in like a third of patients who receive that treatment course.
Yeah, so duration definitely can matter. I guess it is fine if you have a patient on one of the notorious medications for a short-term course, but say this patient needs it long-term. Say they have autoimmune disease or solid organ transplants. What do we do with that?
You know, I feel like in those situations, it can be really tricky because, you know, you want to treat the neutropenia, but those medications are also super important. But the good news is that, you know, because a lot of this is context dependent and, you know, we're talking about dose dependent medications, you might actually just be able to get away with lowering the dose of a medication first.
Nice. Okay. So say this is not a dose dependent neutropenia, it's an immune mediated neutropenia. How do we think about that a little differently?
So for these medications that cause immune-mediated neutropenias, you see a much more abrupt and often much more severe neutropenia.
When you have neutropenia, for example, from clozapine, you start clozapine, you're fine, you're fine, you're fine, you're fine, you're fine. And then all of a sudden, one day your ANC is zero, okay? Your absolute neutrophil count is zero. You have severe life-threatening neutropenia. So immune-mediated neutropenia has this very different pattern to it.
I guess I now understand why Dr. Fried calls it idiosyncratic, right? These meds can cause your immune system to just hijack your neutrophils all of a sudden, and it kind of happens randomly and idiosyncratically. The other common offenders, in addition to clozapine, is going to be, in the endocrine world, methimazole, PTU, and then other meds like dapsone or sulfasalazine can also abruptly drop your neutrophils.
And the reality is that I think people are already familiar with this concept because they know about heparin-induced thrombocytopenia, right? Where the first time you're exposed to heparin, you don't get hit until at least 5 days, right? It's like the 5 to 10 day thing because it takes time to make the antibodies. Whereas if you've been exposed to heparin recently, you may have already been primed, then you can see it in less than 24 hours. Same thing is true for drug-related isolated neutropenia through immune-mediated mechanisms. And it's idiosyncratic, meaning it's unpredictable. The idiosyncratic immune-mediated, you have to stop the drug and never restart it, because if you even give them a little bit of that drug again, their ANC is going to plummet to zero again.
And our experts did recommend that if the patient's ANC is less than 500, that definitely requires a hematology evaluation. But if it's more mild or moderate, you know, ANC in the 500, 1200, more of a gradual process, then you do have time to work it up, just to say it out loud.
Yeah. It's good not to have to rush sometimes. But in summary, you know, start your workup of neutropenia with the question, is there pancytopenia or isolated neutropenia? If it's isolated neutropenia, you can forget the bone marrow biopsy and just do a good medication and symptom review. Pay attention to a trend of neutropenia, you know, especially regarding medications, as if it's gradual, it might be a dose dependent or duration effect, versus a quick drop is more likely immune mediated. So once you diagnose the likely cause of neutropenia, I feel like the next question my patients often have is, will my neutrophil count recover? And if so, when?
Yeah, I feel like that's a great question. When will the neutrophils recover? I feel patients ask it all the time too, especially if they've severe neutropenia, especially considering what we learned earlier, that every day is a dice roll, time is infection, and they can and are at a risk for serious infection.
But, you know, I think the neutrophil count recovery has a lot to do with what's causing the neutropenia in the first place.
A lot of that too comes down with how fast neutrophils are made. It takes, you know, 7 to 10 days to make a mature neutrophil from hematopoietic stem cell to mature neutrophil. And they live in the periphery for 3 to 24 hours. So a lot of it is based on that.
So it takes about 7 to 10 days to make a mature neutrophil. And I guess that's what I've seen when it comes to a patient who has a viral infection and that causes neutropenia. It often does take, you know, 10 days, 2 weeks for that neutropenia count to really get better and things not to be so red in the EMR.
Yeah, and I feel that 10 to 14 day timeline of recovery is true for a lot of medications as well, you know, especially if it's medications that are inducing like an immune mediated neutropenia.
But if you take away the drug, the antibodies don't do anything to your neutrophils. It requires the combination of the drug plus your neutrophils to have an effect. And the good news is that in drugs without long half-lives, once you stop the drug, there's usually relatively rapid recovery.
But we do have a slightly delayed timeline for one big category of medications, you know, dose-dependent medications.
If you remember from your oncology rotations, when you give chemo, you give it on day one, and then there's usually a nadir in their neutrophil count between days 14 and 21, depending on the regimen. And then it starts coming back up around 3 to 4 weeks after you gave the chemo. So the same thing happens with neutropenia from mycophenolate or ganciclovir or these other things that are causing dose and duration dependent. You stop the drug, but it could be several weeks before it comes back up. And a lot of times it's even longer if the way that you're managing this is by dose reduction. Because with dose and duration dependent neutropenia, it doesn't mean you can't use the drug at all a lot of times. It just means that you need to give them less because it's dose dependent.
So like chemotherapy-induced neutropenia, you know, say if it's drug-related like mycophenolate-induced neutropenia, it's going to really peak. That neutropenia is going to really peak at 2 to 3 weeks post-treatment and then start to recover around week 4.
No, I think the general gist is stop the medication causing the neutropenia. Your bone marrow will recover after some time, like 3 or 4 weeks.
What about neutropenia that's caused from chronic disease, like neutropenia related to autoimmune disease?
So that can be a little bit of a tricky situation. You know, on the one hand, you want to treat autoimmune diseases that are causing the neutropenia, but a lot of the medications you use to treat these diseases can also cause neutropenia. So, you know, it feels like a little bit of a catch-22.
I almost think about that situation like in cardiorenal syndrome, where like they have AKI and you're afraid to use diuretics, and then everyone's like, you know, you got to push through, you got to diuresis them, and then all of a sudden their creatinine starts getting better despite the diuresis, and you're like, ah, yes, it's like I knew this could happen, but I'm always so worried it's not going to work how I want it to, right? The same thing is true when you use immunosuppressives that can cause neutropenia in patients who have autoimmune diseases, is that it gets better once you get them on treatment. The same thing is true when we treat people with LGL leukemia. leukemia, who have severe neutropenia, we give them methotrexate, we give them cyclophosphamide, medicines that can potentially cause neutropenia, but it gets better as it starts treating the actual disease. So you have to sort of, you know, trust slash hope that it's going to be more likely to cause the benefit than it is to cause the harm.
All right. So say our patient has a chronic illness that's causing neutropenia. We're hoping the neutrophil count will get better with treatment, but to put on my worst case scenario hat, I guess, what if it doesn't get better? What if the neutrophils don't get better?
You know, to be honest, like sometimes it doesn't. That's a point that our third discussant, Dr. Eric Bowe, a hematologist, oncologist, infectious disease physician at University of Manitoba and Cancer Care Manitoba, brought up.
There are going to be cases, however, where you don't expect the ANC to recover, where myeloid recovery is not going to occur, such as myelodysplastic states, and giving high-dose chemotherapy on the context of myelodysplastic states. The physician shouldn't be waiting around for that ANC to recover that may never recover. And knowing that context can help the clinician manage the patient safely.
Yeah, so then what do we do for these patients, you know, when we don't expect the neutrophils to recover or there's a prolonged neutropenia?
You know, I think the fact of the matter is that these patients with prolonged neutropenia are at higher risk for serious infection. So I think in that case, the most important thing to do for them is to counsel them about new fevers, mouth ulcers, diarrhea, or really any other symptoms concerning for infection.
Yeah, and then I can imagine patients scouring the internet, really finding all these things like wearing special masks or neutropenic diet. I think I've had patients ask me, hey, can I eat fruit? Can I eat salad?
I struggle with that question. You know, I never want to tell people like they can't have fruit or salad, but actually they've looked into interventions such as footwear exchange, protected environments like positive pressure rooms, respiratory or surgical masks, neutropenic diets, which is basically, you know, no fruits or vegetables, and nutritional supplements. But none of those are clearly recommended because there's mixed evidence that they don't really prevent infections for neutropenic patients. And actually a lot of the data tends to side towards that these precautions are not more effective at preventing infections. You know, so let your neutropenic patients eat fruit.
Nice. Yeah, let them eat. Let's summarize what we've learned so far with the neutrophil recovery. It really seems like the timeline can vary based on what the cause is. If it's something viral, immune-mediated cause, then the recovery can be relatively more quick, 10 to 14 days, depending on that half-life of the drug that's causing an immune response. And then as long as the neutrophils are being made, it's going to be around that 10-day, two-week timeline. If it's from chemotherapy or drug-dependent neutropenia, it can take longer, 3 to 4 weeks. And then autoimmune causes can improve with treatment, but might never fully normalize. And then there are some conditions like myelodysplastic syndrome that you might not expect a recovery. I am so excited to have EchoCore 500 digital stethoscope as a sponsor. I actually learned about them accidentally a year or so ago when I'd forgotten my stethoscope and my resident let me borrow his. And I just was like, wow, I've never heard heart sounds or lung sounds this clearly. You just get this extra level of confidence for those moments where you're asking, was that faint crackles? Was that an S3 gallop? And so that's because Echo's digital stethoscope amplifies sounds 40x. And then on top of that, it has noise cancellations. So you can really hear with precision in a noisy ED or with a really loud roommate or other environments. Echo AI is also built in and helps you detect murmurs and AFib earlier. A cool thing also is that you can record that heart sound that you heard, share it later with your team, but on a case presentation. And then you can really trust the diagnostic accuracy. It's backed by 4 million heart sounds and 8 FDA clearances for the devices and the AI algorithms. So those who use Echo are twice as likely to catch heart disease. What I think is neat is that Echo 500 isn't just the digital stethoscope. You can actually also get an EKG tracing right on the app when you place an Echo 500 on a patient's chest. So no more waiting around trying to trace down the EKG machine on the floor. I trust Echo so much that I work with a team to create a special offer just for our listeners. Right now, you can get $50 off plus a free customizable chest piece cover at echohealth.com/corium. Your purchase will be HSA and FSA eligible and may also qualify for CME reimbursement. Plus, Echo guarantees you're going to detect heart and lung sounds more confidently, and if you don't, you can return it with a full refund. Go to echohealth.com/corium. For $50 off plus a free chest cover. That's EKO
www.cornerstone.com/coreum. And with that, let's get back into the episode. Let's move on to febrile neutropenia. I feel like we've all been taught, you know, febrile neutropenia, it's a clinical emergency, time's of the essence. But to be honest, sometimes I like, you know, get all on edge, like, okay, febrile neutropenia patients here, or I'm admitting this person, and I go in the room and I'm like, this person doesn't look that sick.
Yeah, I think appearances can be deceiving. You know, I think there are some patients who are fine with febrile neutropenia, but for those patients who do develop febrile neutropenia and severe sepsis or septic shock, the in-hospital mortality rate can be as high as 50%, as documented by some retrospective studies.
That is a lot. And I guess the takeaway is, like, you know, febrile neutropenia patients, if they get sick, they get really, really sick.
Yeah, so, you know, different societies and guidelines are pretty clear about the timeline for workup and management for febrile neutropenia. You know, most recommend initiating workup within 15 minutes of triage and starting antibiotics within 1 hour of determining febrile neutropenia.
Workup in 15 minutes? That is fast. But here's like my challenge, my devil's advocate to that, because in reality, you know, patients come to the ED with the fever. You don't know if they're neutropenic, and labs take a while to come back, or say somebody calls you or Epic chats you saying they have a fever. You might not know and won't have access to, you know, blood work for a while and don't know how quickly to act.
Given a history, we have done in our guidelines is to use a very simple, sensitive question that's not very specific. It says, if you've had any chemotherapy or anti-cancer treatment at any time in the last 6 weeks, yes or no? And the answer is yes. Then it puts the likelihood that this could be a neutropenic episode. And I think that's kind of unique for any of the different syndromes that you and I look at and manage over from day to day.
Wow, a simple question of did you have chemotherapy in the last 6 weeks can be this helpful? And I guess that goes back to what we learned in our last pearl, that neutropenia can be predictable in these patients.
I think it's predictable if we know the date of the incident that got it going in the first place, or the putative incident. And usually chemotherapy, when did you get your treatment last? Oh, well, yes, Dr. Bo gave me my CHOP chemotherapy 12 days ago. And this is day 12. Well, then I know that pretty much from one patient to another, with some significant exceptions, that when you get that cytotoxic therapy, that the nadir of that neutrophil count is going to be somewhere between day 12 and day 14.
Yeah. But say my patients, you know, did have chemotherapy in the last 6 weeks or so. Does that mean straight inpatient admission for febrile neutropenia, or can some of this be managed outpatient, especially if they're seemingly well appearing?
For the lower risk patients, I mean by risk in this context is risk for medical complications that would either get you into hospital or keep you in hospital if you're already there. For those that would be considered low risk, and that's usually the solid tumor population getting cytotoxic therapy in a cyclical fashion. In that population, we can often, as I mentioned earlier, treat them as an outpatient. And our duration is different because the time to effervescence, at least in clinical trials and in our own experience, is only 2 to 3 days.
Yeah, so, you know, I think patients with solid tumors who are neutropenic are generally considered lower risk because they're neutropenic for a shorter time. I think especially comparing them to, say, like a patient who has leukemia and is getting chemotherapy, I think another reason that breast cancer patient is lower risk is because it's really only the chemotherapy that's affecting their bone marrow, as opposed to the leukemia patient who has both cancer and chemotherapy affecting their bone marrow. So, you know, given that double hit, you would expect the leukemia patient to be more severely neutropenic for a longer period of time.
Interesting. And that makes sense. I think like the next step is to send off an infectious workup, but I feel like often the testing comes back negative most of the time. And what happens if we can't find a source?
Dr. Bo actually broke down neutropenic fever into 3 categories that can help guide your thinking.
When I think about neutropenic fever syndromes, I've always classified them in 3 ways. I'm oversimplifying it. They're either microbiologically documented infections, where I've got a pathogen, and I have a place where the pathogen's coming from, like the blood or the lung in that case. Then the next, of course, is the clinically documented infection, which is by definition, we have a focus of infection, but I don't have a pathogen. And then the last one, which is almost common, is the unexplained fever, where I have a SIRS syndrome, that is systemic inflammatory response syndrome.
Okay, so that's helpful. It's basically thinking through, is it a microbiologically documented infection or is it a clinically documented infection where, say, you have opacities on a chest x-ray but no pathogen? And then last but not least, is it an unexplained fever with SIRS syndrome? And might I say, it feels so rallying to hear someone say that that is the most common scenario, because sometimes I feel like I send off a pretty broad workup and I'm thinking, okay, am I missing anything for this febrile neutropenic patient?
I feel like it can drive you crazy thinking about whatever test to order for these patients. So just to summarize, PEARL 4, which is workup of febrile neutropenia, and how do you move through that 15-minute window to get these patients to treatment? And the first step is to ask patients if they've had chemotherapy in the last 6 weeks as your screening question. And remembering that neutropenia typically occurs 10 to 14 days after cytotoxic therapy. And then, you know, thinking about risk stratification, you can probably more comfortably manage solid tumor patients who don't have their bone marrow affected as an outpatient if they have stable vitals. And then, you know, for patients who you do have febrile neutropenia or sending that infectious workup, you can classify them as having infections that are microbiologically documented, clinically documented, or an unexplained fever.
So let's say we completed the workup of febrile neutropenia in that critical first hour, especially because the mortality is so high, if they're septic, hypotensive. But I think the other big question that comes up is, what's the right antibiotic to start?
And thankfully, the guidelines are pretty straightforward here. You need something that covers Pseudomonas. So the typical three to reach out for would be cefepime, piperacillin tazobactam, or meropenem.
What about vancomycin? I feel like I've seen that added pretty frequently.
Oh yeah, the classic combination of vancomycin or vancomycin. It's a great point. Vancomycin isn't actually recommended as the first line. It's generally only recommended if you have hemodynamic instability or known MRSA colonization and an infection source that's likely to be MRSA. So something like gram-positive cocci in the blood cultures, pneumonia, soft tissue infection, or severe mucositis.
So it sounds like vancomycin is not routine standard of care for febrile neutropenia. It's only based on specific clinical scenarios where there is a high suspicion of MRSA. The other thing, Casey, I feel like I've seen people do when they're really worried about a patient is add fungal coverage.
Yeah, you know, I think your patient's not doing well. You're like, what else can I add on? But I think the question of adding antifungals is actually where the neutrophil count and duration can play a big role as well, too.
Yeah, neutrophils are our workhorse. They, you know, the cell that's the most common, it really fights off like all the infections. And again, bacteria is like the main one, but fungal is common. I do want to emphasize, though, that our concern about fungal infection really isn't there until neutrophils are 200 or lower. And again, that's really in the context of multiple days.
Yeah, I really appreciate hearing this rule of thumb for fungal disease. It's an absolute neutrophil count less than 200 and a duration being at least more than 2 days of neutropenia.
That also generally lines up with guidelines that we'll link to in the show notes that generally recommend adding antifungal coverage if patients aren't responding to antibiotics within 3 to 7 days.
It's not really the neutrophil count that I'm thinking about, even though the neutrophil count is a risk factor for opportunistic infections. But it's the context, the patient with acute myeloid leukemia, and given the kind of treatments that such patients have, the expectation is that they're going to be at risk as a function of severe neutropenia for a lot longer than other kinds of other patient groups.
So risk of fungal infection isn't just about neutrophils being less than 200 or more than 2 to 3 days of that low neutrophil count. It's really also the context, right? And it seems like the highest risk is going to be malignant heme patients like someone with AML. All right, Casey, I'm starting to feel better about kind of what to start in febrile neutropenia. I think maybe the teaching, and more importantly, I think what not to start right away. But I think the other big thing that we often hum and haw about is how long to keep these patients on antibiotics.
It is a question that I feel like I've struggled with a lot and that I've also seen practiced a lot of different ways as well. But all the major society guidelines tend to agree that antibiotics can be discontinued when patients show a trend towards recovery and are afebrile and asymptomatic for at least 48 hours with negative blood cultures.
You know, that first part you said where, you know, trending towards recovery, like what does that even mean? Is it just like, oh, you have 2 days of neutrophils going up, or is there a certain absolute neutrophil count threshold that we feel comfortable, okay, I'm going to discontinue antibiotics in this patient who had febrile neutropenia?
I mean, it's a great question because there is no strict definition of recovery, which is why actually I think you can see a variety of responses. Some clinicians will stop antibiotics based on clinical response and time afebrile, while others might use like a threshold of neutrophil recovery of ANC above 1,000.
We maintain them on antibacterial therapy until they're afebrile for 4 to 5 afebrile days, and then consider discontinuance. Now, typically, now this is where it gets predictable again. In a patient like an AML patient who has a neutropenic fever syndrome, and you give them whatever regimen you have, and if it's effective, it'll take a median of 5 days for them to defervesce. That's just an empirical observation from our clinical trials. So it's a median of 4 to 5 days before they'll defervesce. And if you treat them for another 4 to 5 days afebrile, add that up. Now you're getting close to 10 days.
So it sounds like either way, the body recovers when it recovers. And most patients with neutropenic fevers get roughly about 7 to 10 days of antibiotics total.
You know, the other cool thing about 7 to 10 days is that that's also the expected time for gut mucosal recovery as well, too.
The other organ system that is pertinent to the conversation is the lining of the gastrointestinal tract from the vermilion border to the anal border. And again, a patient getting cytotoxic therapy may have cytotoxic therapy induced epithelial damage of the gut, which again allows for the translocation of colonizing organisms into the submucosal tissue and causing systemic infection. And so part of my thinking here is I have to take into account when I wait to recover. And it typically recovers about the same time as the ANC recovers.
Wow, how cool and convenient that the gut mucosa and the ANC recovery go hand in hand. Casey, let's say we do have an infection source, you know, does that change then how many days we're putting this patient on antibiotics?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, if you identify a specific pathogen or source, that kind of supersedes everything we just said about our 7 to 10 day rule of thumb. You should actually follow the standard guidelines for the infection that you identified.
If you knew it was a Pseudomonas aeruginosa bacteremia, you would then be using the guidelines for bacteremic patients as a guideline for duration of antibiotic therapy.
All right. Last thing to round out our discussion that I've been thinking about a lot as we're talking is GCSF, granulocyte colony stimulating factor. You know, why don't we just give our patients some of this to stimulate some neutrophils and reduce the time of neutropenia, right? We learned time is infection.
You think it would work, but actually it's like the one area where there's pretty strong consensus against routine use of GCSF for patients with neutropenic fever.
Really? I think GCSF would improve outcomes, no?
Yeah, so they did randomized control trials in giving GCSF for patients with chemotherapy-induced febrile neutropenia, which did note decreased hospitalization times and decreased periods of neutropenia, but there were no changes in overall mortality or mortality from infection.
People who care about length of stay will like GCSF then. But yeah, I guess, you know, the fact that there's a strong consensus against it, I guess maybe that goes back up to like Dr. Bowie's point that he made earlier that the timeline for neutropenia recovery, especially if it's chemotherapy induced, is relatively predictable. And if you're already close to that time frame for recovery, then GCSF might not give you much benefit for the cost.
You know, I think, again, like there's always some caveats, and in the right context, like you can consider G-CSF for high-risk patients. So these are patients who have prolonged neutropenia over 10 days, really profound neutropenia under 100 cells per microliter, or other factors that really increase your mortality from infection, like age over 65, severe sepsis, or really bad invasive fungal disease.
All right, so let's summarize what we learned so far about antibiotics. In terms of starting antibiotics, we were going to reach for in febrile neutropenia anti-pseudomonal antibiotics within that first hour and consider antifungal coverage if that absolute neutrophil count is less than 200 for more than at least 2 days, and it's a patient who is at higher risk of infections like blood cancers. And then we're going to continue antibiotics and stop it based on the absolute neutrophil count recovery. You know, some people do have this threshold of, you know, if it's above 1,000 for at least 48 hours, which again also falls usually within the 7 to 10 day range anyway. And then, of course, just to say it, if you do have a specific infection source, then you would let that ride your antibiotic choice duration and not as much the 7 to 10 day rule.
So that wraps up our episode on neutropenia and febrile neutropenia. If you want to add any of your own tips or share challenges, tweet us and leave a comment on our website page, on Instagram or Facebook. Thank you to our peer reviewer, Dr. Hani El-Samkari.
And as always, we love hearing feedback, so email us at hello@coreanpodcast.com. Opinions expressed are our own and do not represent the opinions of any affiliated institutions. Thank you. Take care.